Well, good morning. How are you guys? That's good. Good, good, good. Well, listen, I want to jump right into this. We have, as you know, we're in a series right now called Voices, and these past few weeks, we've heard some great voices, haven't we? Especially last weekend, really great voice. but listen, if you missed last weekend, by the way, I had the privilege of sharing about my trip to the Middle East, and if you weren't here, I would encourage you, go online, you can download the podcast and hear it. We're also going to post a video of that soon because we had a lot of imagery as well, so we'll have that up linked on Facebook and all that as well. So, but today, we're real privileged to have with us a very special guest named Ian Morgan Cron. And I've really been looking forward to having Ian here with us this week, and you guys are going to love Ian. He's a great, in fact, I forgot, hold on, let me grab these books because I wanted to mention these. Here we go. Ian is, he's an author, he is a speaker, he is an Episcopal priest, and I want to tell you real quick, he's written two books. His newest book is a book called Chasing Francis, A Pilgrim's Tale, and this is a book about the life of one of my favorites, St. Francis of Assisi. So if you are interested, the book is actually available out in the lobby today. You can pick it up before you leave. He's also the author of the best-selling memoir, Jesus, My Father, the CIA, and Me. And this is a fantastic book. Both books are available afterwards. Ian will be out in the lobby if you want to pick one up. He'll even sign it for you. Ian divides his time between two homes, Tennessee and Vermont, with his wife, his three children, and his Portuguese water dog named Ella. And we're excited to have him here today. We're thankful that he's with us. You guys are going to love him. And he's going to come and share in just a minute. And then at the end, we're going to take a few minutes just to have a little bit of conversation and a little bit of Q&R, question and response. So it's going to be a good morning. But before he comes, I want to ask you to stand with me if you would. And I want to open up the scriptures. And I want to read to you from Colossians chapter 3. I'm going to put it on the screen and I'll have you read part of this with me. But let me begin. Colossians chapter 3, verse 12 says these words. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourself with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Bear with each other and forgive one another. If any of you has a grievance against someone, forgive as the Lord forgave you. And over all these virtues, put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity. Let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, since as members of one body you were called to peace, and be thankful. Say those three words with me, and be thankful. Verse 16, let the message of Christ dwell among you richly as you teach and admonish one another with all wisdom through psalms, hymns, and songs from the Spirit, singing to God with gratitude in your hearts. And verse 17, I want us to read together. Would you lift your voices? Let's read these words. And whatever you do, whether in word or deed, do it all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. And this is the word of the Lord. Orchard, would you put your hands together and welcome this morning Ian Cron.
There we go. Please remain standing for the whole of my message. That would be helpful. No, please be seated. Thanks. I travel to a lot of churches and speak at a lot of conferences. I'm blessed to do that. And you know, I can always smell when a church is a depository of God's Spirit in a special way, right? And I don't say this everywhere I go, I promise you. Last night was wonderful. How we doing back there? Am I all right? It's no doubt a problem with my voice or something, but I spent time with Ben and with Scott after the service for a couple hours, and I just hope you appreciate what you have together. you have wonderful leaders, very talented people, have a profound love for you and for God and for the work that God has given them. And I feel in your midst the rich humidity of God's Spirit. Yeah? It's sort of in the air. And so I thank you for allowing me to swim in it a little bit for 2 days. And I hope and pray that that presence of God intensifies and accelerates and becomes more and more beautiful among you. I want to start this morning, if it's okay, by reading just a brief passage from this memoir of mine. And I'm not doing this because I want you to, you know, buy my book. I mean, although I have 3 kids in college, so I would be really grateful if, let me give you some context behind the story here. This is a book about predominantly about my relationship with my father, who was a chronic alcoholic. It's the story of my own struggle and journey with alcoholism, now with 26 years of sobriety. It's the story that's both sad in many ways, but also a story of great hopefulness, and there's a lot of laughter in it, as there should be, you know? This particular section I'm going to read to you is one in which I have just gone to a Steve Miller concert. I hope I know some people in here old enough to know what that means. And I was with a group of friends, and we had become, you know, really irresponsible on the drive and partied quite a bit. And a friend of mine named Tyler, who had recently become a Christian, a guy that I used to do a lot of partying with, comes to talk to me about that night a little bit. And hope that gives you adequate background. Tyler called me one Sunday afternoon in January and asked if we could hang out. He suggested we go to the barn where Young Life meetings were held. The people who owned the house usually kept it locked, but sometimes they forgot. Tyler turned the knob and pushed on the door, and it opened. "Sweet," he said to no one in particular. While Tyler turned on the gas heater, I looked around for a place to sit. There was old furniture everywhere, so I randomly picked a green couch to sit on. It was riddled with holes, stuffing pouring from every gash in the upholstery. I perched myself on the arm, and Tyler sat on the opposite one so he could face me. He took a deep breath. "Ian, you're my best friend, right?" "Yeah," I said. "So I can shoot straight with you." I shrugged. "Sure. I know you haven't had it easy with your dad. I've seen how he can act when he's drunk, so I know." Tyler was the only friend I would let come to my house when my father had been drinking. My father could be charming when friends were around, but Tyler had seen the dark side once or twice, and it was hard to forget. He took another deep breath and went on. "Even with all the crap you've had to deal with in your life, you've gotten solid grades, you play in this really cool rock band, you've starred in a few musicals, you've held it together, and I think that's amazing." I was surprised. Instead of letting me have it, he was saying things no one had ever told me before. Not a soul had ever said to me that they knew what I was going through, that they felt what I was going through and admired me for not just holding on for dear life, but for making life work in spite of it. "The night we went to the Steve Miller concert," he said, "was the first time I watched you party when I wasn't doing it with you, and I saw something." He turned back and he looked at me squarely in the eye. "You turn into your dad when you're drunk." My back straightened and I started to protest, but he held up his hand. "Let me finish," he said. you get the same creepy look in your eyes. You talk too much. You treat people like you're more important than they are. You lie about things to make yourself look cool. You even hold your cigarettes and walk like him. Tyler shook his head. Ian, don't become your dad. I stopped breathing. I stared at Tyler and he at me. A gust of January wind put its shoulder to the side of the barn and tried to push it down. Instead, it found a crack in a beam and settled for making it whistle. There was no other sound until I bowed my head and wept. There are acts of love so subtle and delicate that the sweep of their beauty goes unseen. I know of none more miraculous and brave than that of a 17-year-old boy coming to his friend's side to take his tear-soaked face to his own breast. What I expressed or experienced that day with Tyler wasn't sympathy. Sympathy is often good and it's appropriate in many circumstances, but by definition, it's only the understanding of another person's pain and then offering an expression of concern, right? So if you, let's say you lose a pet, you know, someone might say to you, I heard about your dog and I'm sorry, right? It's an expression of concern in light of your pain. And what I experienced that day with Tyler wasn't empathy either. Empathy is also good, but it's really only the act of vicariously experiencing another's feelings, right? Getting in their shoes. And you might say to somebody who's you're trying to be empathic with, you know, I put myself in your shoes and I understand how you might feel that way or how you might think that way. But what I felt that day with Tyler, and very rarely actually in my life many times, was something that transcended empathy and sympathy. It was larger, it was more capacious, it was more important. What I felt that day was compassion. Deep compassion. The word compassion literally derives from a word that means to suffer with. It is to suffer with someone who is suffering. And by the way, that's something that neither empathy or sympathy demands of us, right? We can maintain a safe distance while being empathic or sympathetic, but compassion won't let us get away with that. Compassion says, no, I feel compelled to merge my own heart with the heart of the suffering other, that they may know that I am in solidarity with them, that I identify with their pain, that I will carry it with them. That's compassion, and it's a rare thing, really. It's a very rare thing. Compassion collapses the barrier, right, between your heart and the one who is in pain. But compassion goes well beyond suffering with the other. If you stop there, it actually becomes a little pathological, actually, if you just sort of both of you sit in the mud of the pain of another. It demands action, something that sympathy and empathy also don't require of us. I'm thinking right now of Jesus with his disciples. He's getting them ready for the fact that he's soon going to die. And he says to them, love one another as I have loved you. I find it fascinating that Jesus doesn't just stop at love one another. That seems clear enough, but he qualifies it. He says, just as I have loved you. And I think what Jesus is referring to here is compassion. I would argue, you know, if someone asked me, you know, what was the dominant mood or personality or the way of Jesus had of being in the world, I would say it was compassion. that Jesus was willing to move into and suffer with the marginalized, the oppressed, the broken, the lame, the sick, the blind, and he took action to alleviate the suffering. He took action to alleviate the suffering. Now, this is important. I want you to know that compassion isn't something we activate or recruit when circumstances call for it and then put it back on a shelf when we're done. That's what we could do with sympathy and empathy, right? That's not how it works with compassion. Compassion is a way of being in the world that Jesus calls all of us as his followers to earth or embody in ourselves. It is a way of being here in the world. You know people like this, right? Who they just seem to emanate the spirit of compassion. Even if you're not expressing pain, you know that that compassion is available if you were in pain. Do you know the kind of person I'm talking about? You can almost feel as though there's a ring of concern always around them about where you are and who you are and how you're experiencing your life. Do you know someone like that? Maybe it's, you know, a grandmother or an aunt or your spouse if you're fortunate, or a friend. You just know that they're just radiant. So radiant and with the presence of Jesus that they just give off the fragrance of availability to you. I just think that those rare people are too rare. And I think it's not a gift, although I think some people are more, you know, inclined to the temperament or the gift of compassion. It is called upon for all of us. That you and I would be constantly widening the circle of concern or the circle of compassion around our lives that invites others and lets them know, you are safe here. And if you move into this circle of concern, I will suffer with you and I will do what I can in the power of Jesus Christ to bring healing or some gesture that will alleviate your pain. I think a church needs to be a place that emanates compassion, and that doesn't happen very often these days. I can tell you it doesn't. You know, it seems to me that Christians or churches or bodies of Christians seem to be more preoccupied these days with being right than with being compassionate. Compassion is the Jesus way of being in the world. It's almost as though we're afraid that if we're compassionate towards someone else, that we're giving them a free pass to do whatever they want or something. Or you know, if we're just compassionate towards others all the time, then we'll be taken advantage of. Or if we're compassionate, do you see what I'm saying, right? So I might ask you a question just for reflection. How are you doing with compassion in your own life? Is your circle widening and including more people, even people you may not like, or people from whom you differ? Is this a community that, if you can imagine it, the circle is widening more and more over the city of Aurora, right? Is it welcoming more and more people? Is it not filtering people out at the door, but saying, come and know the compassionate heart of Jesus? We are willing to suffer with you. We are willing to walk with you, and we will do our best to bring healing and new life to you as we have discovered it ourselves. Is this a compassionate house? Is your home a compassionate zone? Do your children feel safe to suffer with you? Do your spouses, do your friends? Does even the cashier at CVS, who's the first day of the job and doesn't know what the heck they're doing and has jammed up the line, does that person feel the emanation of compassion from you towards them? It is a way of being in the world individually and corporately. And the people of Jesus must be known again as the people of compassion. The number one reason, research tells us, that people no longer go to church, younger people in particular, is they feel that Christians are judgmental, condemning, and angry. That has to stop. You can have all the cool music and videos and everything you want, drag people into your church, but if compassion isn't here, it's just Vegas. Do you see that? It's just Vegas. Now, if you're like me, you know, you want to be more compassionate. I'm from New York City, you know. Compassion isn't our first gift. You know, I mean, yeah, our first response to pain is, well, you think I'm stupid? You know, I mean, that's sort of, you know, are you fooling me or something, you know? I want to be more compassionate. And I oftentimes ask myself, how do I do it? Here's what I've learned. It requires me to kind of reframe the question, what does it mean to become a Christian? What is it that happens to us when we become Christians and the Spirit of God makes his home in us and begins to percolate up, right? To change us from the inside out. Christianity, and this is very important, one way of thinking about conversion in Christianity is this. Christianity involves a radical transformation of your vision. It is a new way of seeing. We go from a narrow aperture to something wider. We begin to see things as they really are. As they really are. And I would argue that for Christians, compassion is the lens through which we see each other and every living thing for that matter. It is through the lens of compassion that we're called to see the world. I'm going to do a little exercise with you right now. And I'm a big believer. I'm not a big, you know, like intellectual biblical scholar who's really interested in just giving you more data about Jesus, you know. Because my experience is that, you know, information is just that. Sometimes I like to do things that help people to, you know, move some ideas from here into their own hearts and lives. This is something I often do on retreats. I'll warn you right now, it may create some anxiety for you or a little awkwardness, but that's why you come here, right? Is to have some of your assumptions challenged about how to live your life, because if not, you know, you're just in the fellowship of the comfortable. I hope you don't want to be that, right? So this is just going to take 1 minute. I want to lead you in an exercise that I hope you will experience what having this new vision is like, especially as it pertains to compassion, which I mentioned earlier, is the lens through which I think we are to see the world, through which it is to see, we are to see the world. Underneath your chair, you'll find a piece of duct tape, and I'm going to ask you to maybe just take it out, okay? I think we all know this is true, so this isn't going to be a revelation to many, but all of us bear visible scars or wounds in our lives, right, that others can see, but we carry many others that others cannot see. Yeah? And those wounds intrude into our lives, and for many of us, they are ever present to us. The effects of them, the residual effects of those wounds and those times of suffering in our lives oftentimes create what I call the trance of unworthiness. Do you know the one I'm talking about? It's this little loop in the back of your head that says, oh, I'm not enough. Or, you know, we're left with marks on the soul. We're bruised. We're bruised people. Right? And you can try and eat it away or drug it away or drink it away or busy it away. But this is just the facts. You know what I mean? Like as my spiritual director used to say to me, this is your life, Ian. These are the terms. We're people who are wounded. What I want you to do just for a minute is I'd like you to maybe just take 4 or 5 pieces of tape at most. And I want you to place them somewhere on your person that might represent a place of suffering for you. Last night it was, you know, maybe for example, there was a young man last night in the group. And it was very powerful for me. He just took the whole piece of tape and put it over his mouth. Now, that represents probably a very powerful wound in his life, right? But it may be that you went through a divorce or something. We all know that hurt. Put it on your heart if that's where it's appropriate. So just stand up and do that for me, would you? Just apply a few pieces of tape. It doesn't need to be heavy or maudlin or, you know, involve a lot of tears or something, although it might. Just stand up and do it. Don't be afraid. You know, no one's going to be really shocked that you have some wounds in your life. 30 more seconds, all right? Now, if you would, all I want you to do is very quietly, in a very prayerful way, okay, without making noise, I just want you to look around. It's going to feel a little awkward because, you know, you're going to look goofy with this tape on you and stuff, but I just want you to look around, turn around, look at everybody. Kind of move through the anxiety of that kind of like goofiness and just, you know, look around. And now be seated. And leave that tape on for me, unless you've got it, you know, over your mouth all the way or something. I oftentimes do this on a retreat, and I do it, though, when I give people 2 hours to do this exercise, right? They can really think it out and think about their lives and the place of oneness. And I give them a much longer piece of tape, right? And I can tell you that it's some of the most powerful times I've ever had in community when you come back and people are just covered. And for the first time, you see externalized the realities of how they live life on the inside, of who they are. You finally see it with your own eyes, you know. It's not hidden behind skin. You go, oh. And even though we know everyone's wounded, when we finally see it, we go, dang. I just wasn't in touch with what's really going on in you. Because most of the time, we experience each other two-dimensionally, right? We kind of like stick to the surfaces of the outside of a person until their junk comes out, right? That until their wounds start to make them behave in ways that, you know, bump into our wounds. And that pretty much sucks when that happens because, you know, all kinds of things escalate and turn bad, right? When you are a Christian, and you are given this new vision through which you can see with compassion, you start to see the tape on the outside. You assume it's there as you enter into every conversation, into every interaction. You just assume it's there. And when it does emerge, or when it's called out, you respond out of the space of suffering with them and trying to alleviate it. And it doesn't have to be like if someone's got a big problem, you know, I got to spend the next 2 days solving it. I'm not asking you to solve it. Sometimes it's just like what Tyler did, you know, like just taking a head to your chest. Or it may be that we just engage the eyes longer and that's all they need. Or it may be that the hug lasts 10 seconds longer. Or it may be more than that, maybe more dramatic. You know, I've been involved in, you know, alcohol interventions plenty of times in my life where there's a lot of suffering with, and then the action is fairly dramatic. Sometimes the action is hard. Love can be hard. It's not always mushy and huggy. Sometimes it's hard. But that's compassion. That's compassion. Trust me when I tell you right now that everyone that you see in this room who's just got a few pieces of tape on, I just wanted you to get a sense of the truth of our lives. Every single one of those things is crying out for your compassion. And if we create compassionate hearts, those people will know that they're free to let those things become visible so that they can receive compassion. Are you safe? Is this church safe for those things to emerge? So it could be a house of healing. Is this a compassionate place? Is your home compassionate? Is your office compassionate? Do people know when they walk into your office that that's the spirit they will encounter? Because that's the Jesus spirit. Be kind, Plato says, for everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle. And that's the truth. Everyone in here and everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle. So how do we develop a supernaturally heightened awareness of the wounds and sufferings of others that beg for our compassion? Well, let me, before I talk about that, just say to you that there's one thing that will always stand in the way of this developing these eyes and this awareness and this soft-heartedness toward others. It's the lack of self-compassion. I don't know what it is about Christians. I'm a therapist. I'm a priest. I hear confessions, which may be freaky for some of you, but you know, I've been around. I have plenty of my own wounds, and I've done it to myself. I know very few people who are as discompassionate with themselves as Christians. Isn't that weird? There's a lot of lack of self-compassion among God's people for themselves. They don't interrupt the circuit, you know, that starts to run in the back of our head, that trance of unworthiness very quickly. We actually start to believe it and collude with it and encourage it. Because there's a lot of shame in the church. Many of us came in here because we were ashamed. And sometimes the church, I don't think it intends to most of the time, but it actually encourages us to stay there. You know, I don't know why I would ever come to church on a Sunday morning to feel ashamed by somebody else, but that's what happens a lot of the time. You hear people constantly reminding you of how fallen you are, how broken you are. Can I just tell you something? You're beautiful. You're beautiful. And a church should never be the house of shame, but of restoration. Sure. Are you inclined to screw things up? Yes. But most of the time, let me tell you something. And I don't want to get into a conversation about sin here, the nature of sin, but most of the time, you wound others because of those wounds. That which does not get transformed gets transmitted. And the journey of the faith that we hold, in part, is learning to bring these wounds to the surface into a compassionate community where they can find healing and understanding so that we don't continue the snowball running downhill. Do you see that? But don't forget, you're beautiful. And don't be ashamed. And if you hear the voice of shame in your head, if you hear a voice that's constantly criticizing you, don't assume it's God. Because let me just tell you something right now, and I feel confident of this. It's not. The voice of God will never discourage you. The voice of God will never pound on you or beat you up or shame you. It's not the voice of God. It's a friend of mine who's a Jungian therapist, and he says this facetiously. Oh, that voice in your head is probably your mother. It's not God. It's the aggregate of all the wounds and suffering that we've had and the narratives that have been put into us by others, and they're just running on a loop. And rather than agree with them, we have to look at them with compassion. Because let me tell you something, they're not going away until you look at them and treat them with compassion. And they're not going away unless you are in a community where they're also received with compassion. I love this idea. I hope it's helpful. There are two words for seeing in the Bible. One is just the physical act of seeing. And then there's this other word, it's behold. We don't use this word behold at all in culture. And if you do, you're kind of weird. You don't go like, you know, behold the mailman. You know, that's kind of odd, you know. It's like you just got popped back into an Elizabethan drama, you know. To behold is very, very different. Do you know the look or the gaze that comes, that soft gaze that comes over a mother's face when she's looking into the eyes of a sleeping infant? Right? Or just looking into the eyes of the awake infant. And it's something beyond love, isn't it? They are beholding each other. There's this something greater than love. It's this awe that each other is. And it's more than love. Can I just tell you that you, with all your tape on, that is how God looks at you constantly. And nothing you've done or nothing that has ever been done to you will ever avert or change that gaze. God beholds you. And until you start to behold yourself in the same gaze, with the same gaze, with the same compassionate love, you will have a very hard journey. and you will not be able to extend the compassion you want to others. So, I mean, how do you do it? I'm just going to give you two very simple practices, and I'm only going to give them to you for this very simple reason, because they've radically changed my life in the last 5 or 6 years. And I can tell you that they have not only arisen in me a new compassion for myself and for others, and hopefully a wider circle of concern, but they have done for me what I have not been able to do on my own, and that is to forgive. You see, compassion is the natural climate in which forgiveness can start to happen. Christians often jump, you know, right from an injury to forgiveness. It's too big a jump, people. You can't make an on and off switch like that. You must move through the valley of compassion, where you start to realize that those who've wounded you, or groups of people that have wounded you, or life has wounded you, were themselves wounded. That they were simply transmitting that which was not transformed. Compassion is almost the place of defrosting, where we soften and we find ourselves gentled toward others. Let me just briefly lead you in one practice, and I'll tell you how I've expanded outwards, and then if we have time. We didn't have a clock on up there, so I have no... Oh, we do. Oh, wow, I've got 2 minutes and 45 seconds. I'm rocking. Normally, I'm about... I go speak at churches, and the pastor's running around the background with his hair on fire going... These prayers, these practices, and I know you've been starting to do these in your community. I'm telling you that for 1,500 years, my doctoral work is in Christian spirituality from Fordham University. I can tell you that these prayers work, and unfortunately, in evangelical or Protestant circles, they were abandoned. The language of them was abandoned in the Reformation, and I'm telling you, it's been a great curse to us, because we've ended up in our heads so much that we've forgotten that this stuff has to get worked out into our hearts and our souls. Otherwise, it's just data. And how do we, you know, migrate this down to here? Well, this is one way. Christianity, very important, is not something you do as much as it is something that gets done to you. Let me just say that again, because otherwise, if you don't believe this, you've got a lousy theology of grace. Christianity is not something you do as much as it is something that gets done to you. You cannot transform or reform yourself. All you and I can do is put ourselves in the river of grace and open our arms and say, God, I give you consent to change me from the inside out. And if you try to reform yourself, or if you try to be a Christian, you ever met someone who tries to be a Christian? You can smell a rat, can't you? I mean, they're well-intentioned, but as Mark Twain used to say, he said, yeah, he was a good person in the worst sense of the word. You know, they're just taping fruit to the tree. Instead of, you know, just giving God consent to change them from the inside out, and then the change comes up through the middle, and suddenly fruit starts popping out that even surprises you. That's Christianity. So what do we do? Well, one of the ways of getting at the river of grace are these practices, where we just say to God, here I am. Can't do it. Can't change this. You got to do it. This is a very old prayer, I hope it's helpful to you. I want you just to close your eyes for a moment. If your legs are crossed, uncross them, so that we really are in a physical position of openness. And I'm just going to ask you to close your eyes for a moment. And this is a prayer that I would encourage you to do on a daily basis. And there are many permutations of it. We're just going to do one or two. Close your eyes for just a moment. Take a deep breath, would you? Kind of loosen whatever knots are inside of yourself. And I want you just for a moment to see someone in your life that you love. See their face. And if possible, even see their face as children, when they were children. If you don't have a picture of them, physical picture of them, just imagine it. And now what I want you to do is, as you look at the face of that child or that person, I want you to repeat these three statements. I offer you love. I offer you joy. I offer you peace. Huh? I offer you love. I offer you joy. I offer you peace. And now what I'd like to ask you to do, staying in that space of prayer, is to imagine someone in your mind's eye who actually irritates you. Their wounds are constantly bumping into yours and creating all kinds of havoc. They just drive you crazy. See their faces either now, but preferably imagine them as children. Maybe a sibling or a parent or something. Just see their face for a moment. And then, if possible, try to generate the same warmth you just felt about the person you love in your heart. And as you see them, just repeat the words, I offer you love, I offer you joy, and I offer you peace. You can do it silently or loud as you please. And now, if you would, just do this. Just imagine someone in your life, actually, who has maybe profoundly wounded you. I don't want you necessarily to visit a place of trauma, but someone who's really left their mark on your life, who has bruised you, who has left wounds that require compassion. And do the same with them now. See them as children before they became the people that were wounders, and even say to them, I offer you love, and I offer you joy, and I offer you peace. If you're feeling resistance right now, it's normal. Try and just not push it back or judge the resistance that you're not doing this right, but just to say, I offer you love, I offer you joy, and I offer you peace. And now very gently, come back to the sound of my voice and open your eyes. What I've just given you is a practice very quickly, what I would normally spend 15 or 5, at least 5 or 10 minutes on a day, 15 minutes a day. And I actually have extended mine to be, I offer you love, I offer you joy, I offer you peace, I offer you healing, and I offer you rest. And I do it towards someone I love, I do it towards someone that I kind of get irritable with, someone who's deeply wounded me, and I do it toward myself. I have a little picture of myself that I can think of as a second grader, and I oftentimes just spend 3-4 minutes just saying to that second grader, I offer you love, I offer you joy, I offer you peace, I offer you healing, and I offer you rest. Let me tell you something, this is about getting in the river of grace and creating a compassionate heart toward the world. I do this in airports. I do this, but what I do is I look around, or if I'm in a supermarket, I'm thinking, I offer you love, I offer you joy, I offer you peace, you know, to the, you know, not out loud, because that's creepy, but, you know, I'm not walking down the aisle at Kroger's going, I offer you love, you know, because people get freaked out by that. But do you see what I'm doing is I'm developing a heart of compassion for the world. It's the only way we can do this, people. You can't just come and be passive in a seat. You got to get out there and start to do the work of becoming a follower of Jesus. And there's no other way to do it. It's like a golf swing. You got to go to the range every day and hit 10,000 balls before you get good at it, before it becomes an instinct. Do you see that? Christianity should be an instinct, not something we think about, like I have to do this now, like a robot. It should become so part of us that we're just like doing it. And the only way to do that is to practice. I promise if you do this, It'll change you. But it's going to take some work. Eventually, you may get to need, as I do, 20 to 30 minutes a day of this practice. And others like it that I'm sure Scott and others can describe to you. Here's what I want you to do before I ask Scott to come up, by the way. I don't know if we have time. Do we have time? Yeah, a little bit. When you're out in the hallway together, leave that tape on. All right? It's a little creepy. But remember to take it off before you go into 7-Eleven on your way home, because people will be like, dang, you're damaged. Just say to each other, if you're okay with it, me too. Because so many of us just feel alone in our wounds. And just say, me too. This is a me too church. I get it. And as you see the tape, remember, there's no one in here that doesn't need your compassion. And that every interaction, we must bring that compassion to it. We must clothe ourselves in it as you are clothed now. Let this be a Me Too church and Me Too families and Me Too friends, people of compassion, people who know they're holy and dearly loved, beheld. That's my prayer for you. Scott, did you want to spend a minute or two together? I actually asked Scott if this would be an okay thing to do, because I usually find that the most provocative, interesting stuff comes out in the question and response time than it does in the talk. Although I got a lot of stuff in that one there. That was pretty. I mean, I got a lot of content. Whether it was any good, I don't know, but I got a lot out.
It was good, Ian. Thank you.
Yeah.
I think the orchard is a place where I often see the spirit of compassion among people. And I hear a lot of the stories that you guys don't hear. I see it in action during the week, unsolicited, you know. It's beautiful when compassion flows outside of a program,
mm-hmm.
or outside of a ministry.
Mm-hmm.
It's great when it happens within it.
Yeah.
But when it happens outside of it in a very organic way, it's very beautiful. And many of you have been the recipient of that kind of compassion. I also know, though, for me, maybe I'm the only one, there are seasons and there are times when I don't feel a lot of compassion towards others. And I have to pay attention to that because I think that says something. But can you talk, because there may be some of us here today that feel like maybe they're in that season and they feel like they have to work it up or they have to, like you said, put it on and then deal with the situation and then hang the coat back up in the closet.
Yeah.
What could it mean when we find ourselves having to fabricate, in a way, compassion?
Well, you know, as a recovering alcoholic, you know, we have an expression in AA, which is, you know, fake it till you make it. And there actually is a little validity to that, you know. Sometimes, you know, and by the way, compassion isn't a feeling.
Hmm.
It can be, but it's not. I mean, it's a response. But that response actually may be like, oh, boy. It's not a warm, fuzzy. Oftentimes, compassion is hard and it's awkward. Hmm. But I think we give what we can, people. You know, we're human. You know, you're not supposed to go boo and heal everybody you walk in with. You know, sometimes all we can do is give what we have.
Mm.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Give what you have. I mean, I don't know what else to say except compassion is something that develops in us and it grows over time as we do these practices. And as we, and oftentimes I have to call someone in to be with me in times of compassion to help.
That's good. Let me ask one more question.
Yeah.
There's so many, but, you know, Richard Rohr talks a lot about how the way up is the way down.
Yeah.
Right? And how oftentimes it's through our falling.
Yes.
That we are transformed through our pain.
Yes.
How do we find the balance between showing compassion and letting someone fall? Because
yeah.
The tendency is to want to rescue and keep people from falling when sometimes the falling is what will actually bring their transformation.
Well, I mean, it's really simple, actually. I think sometimes letting the other fall is compassion.
Mm.
Sometimes it is we suffer with them as they fall. But, you know, anyone's got children who are older, you know this, right? Like, there are times when it's like, man, everything in you wants to rescue them or prevent the fall from being too hard. And sometimes you do have to intervene because sometimes the fall could be really bad. Mm. But at other times, it's just like, oh, man, I got to stand back and let this happen because, and be there to suffer with them as it happens. Mm. But compassion means that they're going to have to go down before they get up, you know?
Yeah. It's hard.
Oh.
It's hard to do.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Then I'm suffering and I need someone to comfort me.
Yeah, well, well, we're all connected. That's a very important idea.
Connected.
We are all connected, interconnected with each other. So we do, if one suffers, all suffer.
Yeah. I think this is one of those talks. I would just encourage you to download it and when it's out on the podcast and just listen to it maybe a week from now because it'll speak something unique and different. I was here last night, obviously, and man, I just felt something this morning, even just a little unique. Even as you guys, we were all putting on this tape. That was a really powerful moment. Thanks for leading us in that. I think God was and is moving here this morning in a really beautiful way. Would you just close us out, Ian? Maybe say some closing words and then pray or dismiss us.
Yeah. We're probably pushing time right now, yeah? So maybe we'll skip that song and we'll just go right to a prayer.
I think the song's okay. It's okay. I'm the pastor, so I say we should do it. All right. So.
All right.
If you got to go.
How compassionate you are towards those who are coming to the next service. All right, well, this is a beautiful, just a two-minute piece of music. And the reason I always like to close when I talk about compassion is it's about a 1,500-year-old piece set to a modern setting. I love it because the verse in Latin says this, where charity and love are, God is there. Christ's love has gathered us into one. Let us rejoice and be pleased in him. Let us have awe and let us live and love the living God. And may we love each other with a sincere and compassionate heart. But you just close your eyes and listen to this piece of music. Give you 15 seconds after, and then I'll say a closing blessing, all right? Let me invite you to stand. And just grab the hand of the person next to you, okay? Just an act of solidarity. It's a little goofy, little 70s, but let's go with it. Yeah. And reach across the aisles, for crying out loud. Go ahead, reach. The person on the aisles, reach the person on the other aisle there. Yeah, let's be a family here. So brothers and sisters, Christ above you and Christ below you. Christ upon your right and Christ upon your left. Christ before you and Christ behind. Christ in your eyes, Christ upon your lips. Christ in your heart, Christ upon your feet. As you go forth as individuals and as a family of God to widen the circle of compassion, to extend it to all near and far. And the blessing of Almighty God, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit be on you this day and forevermore. Amen.
Let's thank Ian Cron this morning, okay? Thank you.